Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
October 23rd, 2015, episode 84, Scattering Seeds. Hello, one and all, and welcome to the 84th edition of the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. My name is Kevin England. I'm happy to have your ear to talk about beekeeping one more time. Always fun to sit behind the microphone. Here in New Jersey, the beekeeping year is winding down, but I find myself as enthusiastic as ever. And lately, I've had the fortune of taking in a few beekeeping endeavors, which I'll share along the way. Gotten into my own hives recently, and sat down to prepare this episode, for which I'm pleased to say I have a full agenda. Since I have so much, I'll move past all these pleasantries and jump right in on what we have on the menu so we can get started. First up, I want to talk briefly on the theme of this episode. I have a short feature on the history of beekeeping in New Jersey, a couple factoids, and more importantly, a little concept on the notion of scattering seeds. Along the way, I'll share some coverage of a proposal for antibiotic products made with honey lactic acids, including a mead you can buy today. We'll tell you about some blue banded bees, a notion about the flow hive, been rethinking that, an update on the NJBA pollinator planting project, a couple listener mail items to cover, and other odds and ends to close out the episode. Before we get started, let me get out our contact information so we can have that out of the way for the episode. Our webpage, www.bkcorner.org. You could reach me for comments, questions, requests for topics, anything that matters. Via email, kevin@bkcorner is my email address. Our podcast is available on iTunes or wherever you find podcasts these days. I do, by the way, appreciate any ratings you might consider for our effort. One such review came our way yesterday. Herschel writing in to say, Kevin does an excellent job of keeping all beekeepers of various experience levels informed on what is going on in the world of bees. His local hive reports have been helpful to me as a new beekeeper to keep me from becoming discouraged if when setbacks occur. Highly recommended. You know, thanks, Herschel, for taking the time for that. Good, bad, or indifferent, no matter to me, I'm just happy to hear from people that they appreciate the effort or when they let us know we can do better. Let me put out one more contact type thing. We have a YouTube channel for the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association, of which I'm currently serving as president. A lot of stuff we do in combination with the Association and Beekeeper's Corner post videos up there, a bunch of new ones recently. YouTube.com/NWNJBA is the resource for that. Okay, let's get to the local hive report and see what's going on in our area here. For this episode's local hive report, we'll report that we have one hive on the property and three on the farm. Last weekend, I went through the smaller of the two hives on the property, only to find out that this hive was out of commission. I speculated in the past whether this hive was operational, and I'm not sure if I was delusional or simply hedging my bets, but the last physical inspection showed that it went queenless and they were looking to raise a queen. I saw a couple queen cells in there, and I knew that they were either going to succeed or implode. When I opened the hive to check it, I found that it had been completely robbed, and I could tell that by the weight before I even went inside, and that the small cluster that was trying to rebound was dead and in a pile on the top bars of the bottom box. I can only speculate that they were overtaken by the other hive in the yard, and in the process we lost what was left in that colony while they were trying to defend themselves from the onslaught of the bigger hive. If I had known, I might have been able to shake these bees out in the yard, and then they would have perhaps joined the other hive. But in the end, the colony was empty of any life and resources. It had been stripped completely bare. and I broke it down and brought it back to the garage. So the other hive on the property was in a frenzy last Saturday, and I could only guess that it was a neighboring hive or hives from across the way that were trying to rob it as there was a war going on at the entrance. I closed it down to two small holes at the entrance and refrained from opening up to do an inspection given the onslaught that day. My initial thought was to inspect and button down this hive for winter, but because of what was going on, I left it and have to go in it this weekend instead. The box is heavy. It's a monster. Let me recap its configuration. It has a solid bottom board, a deep, a medium, a deep, and two medium supers. I'm being facetious, but this thing weighs 1,000 pounds. When I tried to do a heft test, I couldn't even budge it. That's the way you want a hive, fat and happy going into winter. So I'm not going to rest on my laurels here. My guess is that it has a large colony of bees and tons of stores, but can't leave it to chance. I'm going to go in one more time this weekend. And there's been overcast skies and only highs in the 50s, but today it was 70. This weekend coming up, we're supposed to see mid-50s and higher overnight temperatures, so I'm going to hold off and do my final inspection then. If it were not for the need to pull out the Apivar strips, I might have considered leaving it be, but I do want to get a final read on it before winter, and I want to take care of that last to-do item, as you don't want to leave Apivar strips in the hive longer than they're supposed to be. As far as what's going on at the hives at the farm, they're doing pretty well. I did get to do my final inspections on the polystyrene hive, and it's in good shape. It has two full deeps of bees, one very full medium on top, and another medium that has three or four capped frames in it. I put that last one on late, hoping that maybe they would pack it out. And they have drawn comb across most of the box, except the far two frames on the left side when looking at it from the front. They're still foundation. But I've been giving them this last vestige of feed, hoping that maybe they could build that out and they'll have two deeps, two medium supers on top. So they just started putting wax in some of those foundation areas, and I'm going to bring some drawn comb over there if I find out that they didn't, and I'll let them fill that out instead. So the point here is that there's 10 frames in the box, 4 of them are capped, 3 of them are foundation, 2 of them are foundation and the rest are drawn comb. They're starting to fill out that drawn comb, but they don't have it capped yet. If I pull that foundation out and give them drawn comb, I think they'll be in good shape. So, yeah, I had to sit here and think about it while I was telling you. Sometimes the gears don't mesh very well. It looks good. I'm happy. One of the things I notice about this hive is even in the cooler weather, it tends to be flying more, which you hear about polystyrene, and I'm witnessing it firsthand. So, last year, this hive was in reasonable shape, and it got robbed really late. This year, I was sure to put a entrance reducer in it early, like towards the end of September. And while they have a closed-down entrance, they have been able to protect the hive, and I think it's in pretty good shape. So the other hive over there, you recall, is the package hive, one we started back in the springtime. It had a full box of bees on the bottom and a pretty full deep above it. The hive is heavy and bringing in tons of pollen, which is an indicator to me that they're building brood. And at this time of year, this is the overwinter brood, so that's good news. I pulled the Apivar strips that I had in them, but ran out of time to do a mite check. And this weekend, I'm hoping to get in there and just see where the mite situation is. I guess if it's too cold, maybe I will hedge my bets and let it ride through winter, because at this point, I don't know if I'm going to do a further treatment. It's getting towards the end of October, and it's going to be cold every night. And anyway, to the point of the second super on the poly hive, I could also pull that off. Do they really need two supers? And put it over this hive so it has two deeps and a medium of honey over top. You might be able to discern that I'm still trying to work out some of these notions of what I want to do here. So I don't want to forget to mention the nuke box that was over there. Upon inspection of it last weekend, it had three frames of bees and some pollen honey stores in the bottom box. And two frames of bees and one partially built out frame of capped honey in the top nuke box. The three frames of brood on the bottom were there against the left wall when looking at the front of the box, and the two frames of brood on the top were also against that left wall when looking from the front. So I've been feeding this hive, and I really wanted it to be fuller with bees and stores. But the migration cover that I had a hole for a mason jar feeder on the top, and I've rationalized that I haven't been feeding them fast enough to build it out. I really wanted the boxes to be full and fat and heavy for winter, but they're not getting there fast enough, and I don't visit the yard every day in time to refill that mason jar. So I did a different strategy, and I pulled the hive apart, and I put all of the bees down in a bottom single deep. So now I have five frames of bees and a couple frames of stores, pollen and honey, and a couple frames of drawn comb, and I put a top feeder on it, and with the weather being warm, I've loaded it with gallons, hoping that they'll fill in the rest of the box and maybe be able to build some more bees before it actually breaks. Now, we've had our first frost here in New Jersey this past week, but we've also had more seasonably warm days than usual. To that point, my concern is that these bees, all of them, are still fairly active, and the ones on the farm, I put a little more sugar solution right up on top of them in case they're eating down what they have. So the thought is here that if we have a warmer than usual October-November period, and they eat some of these stores, maybe they won't have enough to get through winter. So to curb that off, I'm putting just a little extra sugar solution. Pragmatically, the answer is I had one more bag of sugar, so why would I not make the solution and put it on top of the hives? One of the questions, and I went over there this morning and looked at them, is whether or not they would take that down. If the liquid gets cold, maybe they won't eat it. Anyway, that's the local hive report. Everything's kind of working along, and I'm waiting to see how to close the season down. And I do believe if I can get in, if the weather's okay, I have something on Saturday all day, so it's going to be a Sunday look, and there's some chance of rain in the morning on Sunday, and I have a soccer game in the afternoon, so we'll see what happens. Such is life of a busy person. So my notion for that deep is that I know I was going to try and overwinter a nuke, but why would I not put them in a deep, fill them out to the full deep, and then try and overwinter them in a deep box? That's where I'm going with that, by the way. So I'm still pondering those final plans for 2015, and I'll have the next week or two to work out my actions. So one last thing about my manipulations over the farm. I switched the hives to full bottom boards from screen ones. And I think I might just leave it this way from now on, or at least until I build a new bottom board this winter that I have in mind. It's a combination screened and solemn bottom board device with the new entrance style that I've been thinking about. I want to try if I have some opportunity over the winter to build a prototype of it. And I'll talk more of that as winter approaches and I firm up the designs that I have in mind. So going into winter, I'll have three full hives and one deep slash nuke combination, depending on where I land. And unlike previous years where I've experimented with no feeding, this year, more than any year in the past, I fed my bees. They seem fat and ready for winter. And I've been optimistic before and suffered letdowns, so I'm not going to be overly enthusiastic about changes to my fortunes this year, but I'm happy with the way things are going with another year of beekeeping learning under my belt. Segment number one, New Jersey honeybee business. It stands to reason that beekeeping has been part of the landscape since the settlers brought bees over with them from Europe to Virginia in the year 1622. As it's known, the white man's fly had transcended the East Coast from that landing spot all the way to Massachusetts by 1640, and like other insects brought over, were able to increase their range by moving into new territories. Beekeeping, selling honey, and creation of products of the hive go as far back as the settlers themselves, and while they were likely not commercial operations like we have today, it's probably true that you'll find many skeps in the backyards of our forefathers, and products of the hive were highly sought after in these early economies. New Jersey itself has a steep history in agriculture, as it was a hub for food products for both New York and Philadelphia. And in the times of Benjamin Franklin, you could read adverts in his 1700s Pennsylvania Gazette that called for bee products with the notion of bartering for goods and services. Honey and beeswax were highly sought after. If you think about that from honey standpoint, they did have table sugar at the time, what we consider table sugar, but it came from plantations. And the fact that it had to be brought in by a boat is not the same notion as the global economy we have today, where things come overnight. So it's probably more practical that people extracted honey from a hive, and it was more readily available in that context from small producers. I guess you also have to consider that people back then knew the value of beeswax for candles, something that is, quite frankly, totally lost on today's generation, as they can get paraffin wax candles for less money. Back then, you could purchase items in exchange, just like cash. There was another notion of how valuable the beekeeping trade was, as reports through time tell of the commerce and importance of beekeeping in agriculture and not just financial. At home, forefathers knew that orchards, where several hives were kept, always produced more fruit than those which there were none. New Jersey has long been known for its products that relies upon honeybees. Even back in colonial times, corn, squash of all kinds, carrots, pumpkins, strawberries, and other products that New Jersey produced in its agricultural history were dependent upon beekeeping. To this day, the influence of the Campbell Soup Company can't be underestimated, as it has left its indelible mark on the landscape of southern New Jersey. It was started in Bridgeton, which is not that far from Camden, New Jersey, Camden being across the Delaware River from Philadelphia. Much of the heritage of agriculture in the southern part of New Jersey owes itself to the products of Campbell's, and it goes in line with the theme of this podcast. So scattering seeds and podcasting has an odd kind of roots and genesis. I learned on a podcast recently, one that I was listening to, that there was a radio station in Utah, when radio station was just starting out, that decided they needed to figure out what their content was going to be, who their listening audience was. And they're in Utah, and the primary occupation of its listeners were farmers. So the notion was to provide information in sound bites about agriculture. And what they were trying to do, the charter of the radio station, was they wanted to be like farmers planting a field, and they came to the notion of scattering seeds. And how do you scatter seeds? You broadcast them, and that's where the term broadcasting came from. How cool is that? I love that little factoid. So what are we doing here on the Beekeeping Podcast? We're broadcasting and scattering seeds of beekeeping knowledge to you, the listener. Yeah. If I think about this, each one of us is in business, so to speak. You're in business to have hives in your property and to have them overwinter and to get products of them. Maybe you're not going to sell them to the public. Maybe you are. Maybe you're not making products of the hive out of your wax. Maybe you are. I don't know what you're doing with it, but you are scattering seeds. Each one of us is a beekeeper working in the greater scheme of beekeeping. And some of my listeners are commercial folks. And the New Jersey honeybee business is about us, even if we do or do not sell products. And I think that's really cool. So I know it's a little sappy, corny, whatever, but yeah, scattering seeds like that. So it's probably a terrible overstatement to say Campbell's Soup is responsible for the garden state that New Jersey is. But it had a little bit to play. And to this day, if you drive down through southern New Jersey, you still see fields and fields of agricultural products. And we have the blueberry industry down there. We have cranberry bogs and other things that are grown here. And they all still are dependent upon honeybees. So we do have, of all the states in the nation, a thriving culture of beekeepers because of New Jersey business and our agricultural state. So that's pretty cool and ties it all together. I'll leave it there and you can think about that for your state where you live if you're not a New Jerseyan. Broadcast, spreading seeds. Good one. Segment number two, antibiotic mead. I've come to appreciate good mead ever since meeting and drinking Sergio Mutella's mead from Melovino Meadery. I've had other meads, including some that I've made at home, and while very good, nothing compares to the flavor and drinkability of what Sergio is producing. So mead, something that was foreign to me prior to becoming a beekeeping, is now in my lexicon of possible adult beverages to drink. Occasionally you see stories that tell you to consume one glass of wine a day for health benefits. Well, what about one glass of mead or some other honey-based product? So let me offer an interesting twist on the ramping up of honey-based products for health. Researchers in Sweden are launching a mead product, a fermented mix of honey and water, but are distinguishing their product by mixing in the 13 beneficial honey lactic acid species, made up of 9 lactobacilli and 4 bifidobacteria, which are present in a bee's honey crop, also known as one of the bee's honey stomachs. Huh? What? All right, hold on. I'll get there and explain this in English. You might say, well, raw natural honey has good stuff in it already. Not so fast. According to their research, the beneficial bacteria are only viable outside the bees during a few weeks in harvested honey and not present in mature honey or honey-derived products harvested through beekeeping. In short, all of these honey lactic acids that can benefit us humans and or other critters vanish after a short while. They have a shelf life. So PhDs Alejandro Vasquez and Tobias Olofsson are working on a solution and have an Indiegogo campaign to raise funds to carry on this research. And if successful, they want to bring products to market. An Indiegogo campaign, by the way, is one of those campaigns where people crowdfund an idea. And one such product that they had for production is a mead product that they called Honey Hunter's Elixir. With this product, they're making 100 billion of these 23 different living and collaborating lactic acid bacteria available in the product in hopes that they can improve the body's ability to fight infections. Kind of like an internal antibiotic that you drink. The scientists aspire to translate this discovery of their lactic acid concoction into products in the area of functional foods, veterinary, and human medicines. They've already published research that demonstrates that they can cure chronic wounds in horses that have proved resistant to treatments using this methodology. So the thinking on the mead product is that you can consume the drink and the antibacterial substances in the lactic acid that they got from the bee's honey stomach. You consume this and it'll be transferred to your blood and help you if you were to be infected with a dangerous bacteria, or it would promote general health by preventing infections before they even took hold inside of you. It could be noted that the research team hosted an Indiegogo campaign that I mentioned to raise monies for their research. Unfortunately, the campaign is closed right now, and it only raised 3% of their goal of $365,000. It notes on their website that they're in a lab mode and sorting out their campaign with a relaunch in November 2015. So here's what I say. Take a look, stay posted, and let's see what we could do to support them in their quest to improve life through honeybees. If you want to learn more about this work, you could visit their website at livingbiotics.com. Visit our show notes for the article from Reuters, that talks of the mead, and a link to their homepage and a link to the Indiegogo campaign that was hosted this past summer. If we only knew about it back then perhaps we could have helped them out. And I'm going to keep an eye on their campaign when it fires up again, and I'll bring it back in a roundtable. I set a reminder to go back and peek at them in November. So before I leave this topic, I wanted to just mention this one thing. We know through the press that certain discoveries that beekeeping has provided answers to problems that plague human beings worldwide and or on the cusp of them. So I don't know if this is pseudoscience. I don't know. I'm Joe Blow reporting on a story I found on a website. But I do know this. There are scientists who are finding products of the hive that can kill viruses that they can't kill. So they found this in propolis. They were able to kill the AIDS virus that way. We know that they found something in the poison of bees or insects, whether it's wasps and so on. I mean, they're finding things that they didn't know about, these products. And here's another area, these lactic acids. Listen, you would have thought this would have been goofy science, but go upstairs and look in your refrigerator. You see these probiotic products being released out of yogurts. So why not honeybees? Pretty cool. Check out the links in our show notes. Segment number three. This one's called Zombie Bees. Listener Lauren Bruns shared a link about news that is getting a little too close to home. I've been watching this story out on the West Coast about the Apocephalus brialis fly. Yeah, I'll spell that in a few minutes. And its attack on bees and wasps. This fly has been known to afflict bumblebees and yellow jackets, which, by the way, are often referred to as bees, but they are indeed a wasp. But it was a story that's been reported over the past few years about the discovered impact to honeybees that has my interest. The backstory is that in 2008, a San Francisco State University biology professor by the name of John Hafernick, Hafernick, noticed that some bees were acting erratically one night outside of his campus office. When he got a moment, he checked the bees, and out of one of them, he saw a pupa emerge. Kevin Moment kind of harkens back to the Alien movie, if you think about it. End of Kevin Moment. So since 2008, there's been a watch on, and this crowdsourced monitoring program and this so-called zombie bee watch has been on ever since. Little by little, the observations have been reported, and Lauren's article indicates that it was recently reported in the area of Burlington, Vermont. To my fellow New Jersey mid-Atlantic region beekeepers, I say what is more disconcerting is that this phenomena has been spotted in California, Washington, Oregon, South Dakota, and unfortunately, two cases were recently confirmed in the Hudson Valley just north of New York City. That is a little close for comfort. So what qualifies as an infected zombie bee? This fly that I mentioned earlier attaches itself to the bees and injects its eggs, which in turn grow inside the bee. Hence the alien scene. Another Kevin moment. The alien scene was great, but it was actually better when it was recreated in Spaceballs. End of Kevin moment. The outcome of this is that it appears to impact the insect with neurological damage, resulting in erratic, jerky movements and unusual night activities. These so-called movements at nights have been said to make the bees act like a zombie, hence the name zombie bees. Perhaps more than anything, it's the label that's making it more detrimental than it actually is, according to scientists. Because if you have been living under a rock, zombies are hot right now. Movies and TV and songs and things like that. It's well known from documented cases in the San Francisco area, and fortunately, because of its notoriety, it's being monitored. So therefore, it's going to be reported on because the press just loves the sensationalism of it all. It really makes an appealing headline when you talk about zombie bees and the buzzing dead. Scientists and researchers, however, are urging everyone not to jump to the conclusion that this is what's causing CCD. Yet another mystery to throw on the pile, of course. And that the bees are not doomed from this infliction. They seem to be saying, while we certainly don't need any further pressures on pollinators and bees, we need to be cautious about jumping to conclusions and assume for now that this is not a big problem. I hope they're right. I'll provide a link in the show notes to the source story that Lauren shared with me, but feel free to Google or Bing zombie bees or Apocephalus borealis flies. Let me see if I could spell that for you so you know how to look it up. Apocephalus is A-P-O-C-E-P-H-A-L-U-S. And Borealis is B-R-E-A-L-I-S. And they're a type of fly. My guess is if you look up any article on zombie bees, somewhere in there it'll have the name of the fly. You could get it better than me spelling it to you. That's all the prepared segments I had for the episode. Let's go to the back of the book. We call this Roundtable. It's just a smattering of topics, editorials, things like that, up-and-coming activities. First one is Roundtable number one, Blue Banded Bees, or Amygilla cingulata, A-M-E-G-I-L-L-A-C-I-N-G-U-L-A-T-A. I'm into spelling things tonight. These blue banded bees are a type of solitary bee. They're one of the many buzz pollinators that hang on to a flower and buzz their thorax, much like a tuning fork action. This is referred to as sonicating, a term that I wasn't aware of and can be the term of this episode. They sonicate the plant and it causes the pollen to puff out. My lovely wife shared the information about blue-banded bees, and I wanted to go take a look at it, and I found this really cool video that I watched on the topic where an expert on the solitary bees, Megan Howcroft, discussed that the bee can be found in tropical and subtropical regions, urban areas, woodlands, forests, and such in the countries of Australia, Papua New Guinea, Indonesia, Eastern Timor, East Timor, Malaysia, and India. So not only were these bees cool, but in the video they showed how to make nests so you can have them in your backyard. The folks in the video discussing this made the nests out of a few common materials, cement blocks, builder's sand, and some cut-up plastic downpipes. Of course, we're not going to find these bees in the United States, but don't despair. We actually have solitary bees throughout our area, and in my mind, facilitating these type of insects in our own locale, which, by the way, are great pollinators, only increases your forage plants throughout your local habitat. I was drawn to this by the name, and as beekeepers, it seems interesting to think of a bee that has a blue band, and one probably wishes to know what one looks like. They actually look somewhat similar to our Apis mellifera bees, but they have an alternating pattern of thick dark stripes on the abdomen, which are interrupted by small, sharp, light color lines that separate the bands. In some of the photos that I've seen of this particular insect, they appear to have black in the thick bands and a light powder blue in the light stripe areas. In other shots, the blue is amped up and almost iridescent. Whatever the case, they're really cool, and you could feel free to check them out if you get a chance. Again, just Google or Bing them. My recommendation is that you search for blue-banded bees and watch a few of the more popular videos to get a sense of what they are. You could also check out the photos, of course, and see what I mean about the color striations. In my search results, there were several options for seeing them, including one from EnviroTube, which is the one particular review that one particular video that this review was focused on. We'll have a link to that video in our show notes if you just want to go over there and click on it. Roundtable number two, I wanted to circle back on the Flow Hive. I have an app called Flipboard, which many are probably familiar with, and I have a channel set up for beekeeping and get to read a lot about the lighter side style articles in there about people who have taken up beekeeping, swarms hanging off airplanes, you know, kind of like cops, bad boys, what you gonna do? People doing novel things about bees, and oh yes, if you want to throw in the pile of human interest stories on beekeeping, you cannot miss the Flow Hive. There have been a far number of articles about the Flow Hive in that channel over the last 6 months. In the beginning, so many of them were about this magical device, how wondrous it was, a hive that you turn the spigot and honey appears. The amount of money raised and the story of the entrepreneurs inventing the Everyman hive. But over time, that magic device has been, well, harpooned, lampooned, made by buffoons. I mean, seriously, the backlash has been swift, cruel, and in my eyes, unwarranted. I have said many times in the past that I love the entrepreneur spirit. Wait, Kevin moment. I hate that word. I can't find a suitable replacement. I hate that word, entrepreneur. I can never spell it correctly, and for all the times I use it, I probably say it wrong because it just feels like mush coming out. Entrepreneur. This word and another pet peeve, the word conscientious, and a few others, I can never spell or say them well. You have your own? I bet you do. Think of them. Okay, end of Kevin moment. Oh yeah, the Flow Hive. Okay. Lately, every article about it, in Flipboard at least, and also out across the web, has been about how diabolical it is and how it's the bane to the fabric of the natural ways of beekeeping. A mechanized, industrialized, and God forbid, plastic contraption that has no place in the beloved Langstroth hive provided to us by our forefathers. All right, hold on a minute. Some people need to give this a rest. You know, I might have my misgivings about the Flow Hive, but I've not had any practical hands-on yet, so I'm willing to wait for a fair assessment. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I love, love, love the ingenuity of it. But this plastic industrialized thing has been blown ridiculously way out of proportion. You know, a lot of people are feeding bees at this time of year. News flash, just about every feeder on the market is made of plastic. Boardman feeders? Mostly plastic, if not all. Top feeders lined with plastic trays. Internal division board feeders? Yep, mostly, if not all, plastic. Plastic foundation. How long has this been in use? I mean, seriously, we need to get over this. But plastic is evil. Plastic, plastic, plastic. You know, we humans ride every day in cars made with plastic. Plastic, by the way, that gets heated up and gases out into our atmosphere when the car doors are closed and you leave the thing parked in the parking lot. Open your refrigerator. Ketchup, mustard, and just about any condiment comes in plastic, and it's stored in a cold state. Cold. While people say not to do this, we store our foods in plastic tubs and even, against good medical advice, reheat them in the microwave. You know, I read this stuff about how this plastic flow hive contraption, which, by the way, is food grade, is unsafe for honey storage. We're going to consume it. You know, the hive, it gets hot and cold. Who knows what this insidious plastic is doing to our beloved honey and what we're going to eat. Okay, I'll stop the drama, but you get the point by now. You know, there's comments about the perception of this hive and that people think they're just going to put bees in it and harvest honey. I'll support the notion, call it what it was, and say it was critical of that messaging that was out there first. But, and this is important, the inventors responded to this. The inventors responded to this. They have been on a campaign since the success in press and the media and using their voice there to assure the community that they will support these devices with insight on how to keep bees properly. So notice what I said there. They're assuring this to the community. They're telling us, the community of beekeepers, the ones that have been vocal about this. Why? Well, maybe some people say they're trying to protect their profit margins, but I think it's because they don't want to be perceived as evil. They care to do the right thing. You know, first and foremost, and let's not forget, these people were beekeepers. They're not some conglomerate that's come in to revolutionize the beekeeping industry with no regard to the subtleties of it. They're everyday beekeepers like you and me who had a passion and to this day think they were doing the right thing from the beginning. So let's evaluate that statement. There's some merit to the notion that if you don't have to disrupt the hive to harvest honey with this method, you don't have to take the box off to remove the frames to harvest them. You don't have to risk killing some bees in the process. You don't have to let the heat out of the hive when you remove the roof. So fair and balanced reporting would espouse these notions and concepts, but lately all I hear is all the insidious stuff that people can make up about it. I'll go as far as saying there's merit to the notion that this could be an evolution in the way that we harvest honey, without using the word industrialization. You know, that's the thesis of what they're doing. And love it, like it, hate it, they were not trying to be nefarious and make millions of dollars. They were trying to be entrepreneurial. Damn word again. Bravo. I still say bravo to them. In the end, after my little diatribe, you might still say this thing is snake oil, an overpriced, plastic, mechanized contraption that has no business in a beehive, and you might be right. Like many things in nature, in future, in industry, in popular culture, this thing might just go the way of the dodo bird, and we'll have to wait and see that it was a flash in the pan, or it might be here to stay. I met somebody today who said they ordered one and they happened to live in my hometown. And I asked them to let me know when they got in and I would help them come and set it up. I still entertain the notion that I might just order one of these. If I don't have the ability to see one in person, if something happens and the thing didn't happen, I just might, you know, for science. For roundtable number 3, I want to talk about the NJBA JCP&L row project update. The New Jersey Beekeepers Association, through the leadership of one of the officers there, Joe Alvarez, is continuing its partnership to produce bee-friendly plant areas in the state of New Jersey. An update of the progress of this project and timetable for the pilot with the Jersey Central Power and Light Company was recently shared to the members. And since July, they've done a site inspection, assessed weed management, landed on the seed mixes to be applied to the areas, and have built out the plan for execution of applying said mixes. Seed planting is targeted for about now, the mid to late October timeframe, and in cooperation with JCP&L will continue for about 3 years to reseed as necessary and establish a bee-friendly, I'll call it causeway, that's my word. There's some 18 seeds in the mix that they intend to disperse, including purple coneflower, lavender, coreopsis, milkweed, spiderwort, sunflower, bergamot, aster, goldenrod, mountain mint, and a few more. An objective of the planting project is to provide a mix of beneficial plants that are native and will bloom all year long for the pollinators. In this project, NJBA will have the task of prepping the soil, planting and monitoring the seeds, and they'll be doing any funding of the purchase of the seeds and equipment needed for broadcasting. Hey, there's that word again. JCP&L will be the liaison to the municipal offices as needed, and they'll help with the preparations of the area. Also in this mix is a partnership with the Land Conservancy of New Jersey. This group will be mowing the proposed reseed area and supply volunteers and monitoring for the area for germination rates and plant identification success across the 3 years it will take to get the area established. Me personally, I am a huge fan of this idea and see a future where it can be the blueprint to do other projects in the state, such as maybe highway medians and other utility roadside right-of-ways. I don't know that the NJBA has the time or resources to become an agricultural ambassador for the region and take on all these projects, but in time I hope that this evolves to become a fruitful endeavor and is successful, and maybe, just maybe, it can become the blueprint where I drive along roadsides in New Jersey and, like other states in this nation, see acres and acres of native pollinator-friendly habitats restored. Wouldn't that be great? I give a tip of the cap to Joe for his leadership and everybody else in the NJBA who's been involved with this. And also a thanks to the Land Conservancy of New Jersey and JCP&L for the partnership. Great work, everybody. Roundtable number 4. This is a listener mail. Late Apivar is the name of this roundtable. I got a question about whether a late mite treatment of Apivar was any value from a sheepish beekeeper who had that sobering moment that they probably should have done some mite management for winter bees long ago. The question is it worth it, and would Apivar be the right treatment since it's easy to apply? Sure. That's my answer. Apivar is better than nothing at this point. You know, while it's really, really late, it's not unheard of for bees to keep operational in New Jersey leading up in earnest to the changeover from fall to winter. Like today, where it was unseasonably warm, they do occasionally get flying days, and that allows them to break cluster and move around in the hive. If they can come in contact with the Apivar strip, then they can distribute some of the product around. Now, this is not the answer when the state apiarist looks at the profiles of the people who didn't treat till September and October. The results are not very good, but it's better than a sharp stick in your eye. What concerns me more is a couple other difficulties. What happens when you put this product in there and it gets cold and you don't have the chance to remove it? There's a period of time, according to the instructions, when you should pull it out, and you should never ever leave the product in there. What we really don't want is the bees to become, and mites have a great way of doing this, resistant to whatever the product is and make it ineffective. Another notion is that you might be doing your last-minute emergency feeding, and that they're going to convert that to sugar honey, And whatever's in there, it might not be safe because it's in the hive when you're getting to the spring nectar flow. So first we have to recognize, like it or not, that if we treat with these products, there is honey for the bees and there's honey for us, and the two do not mix. You want to make sure that any product that you're feeding to the bees right now is consumed really early in spring and doesn't somehow inadvertently end up in your extraction next year when you're pulling your honey flow off. So, you know, late apivar, it's doable, it's better than nothing, but make sure you get it out of there and make sure you don't feed anybody tainted honey. And by the way, I think if you look at the product label, it says that it doesn't really taint the honey. Don't quote me on that. Go read the label. But they don't want you to risk that notion. So they tell you to make sure that you're not going to leave honey on there that humans are going to consume when this product is being used for treatment of mites. Roundtable number 5, episode 83, looking back, it's on video. I think there were hints in our last episode that there was a video version and an audio version, but I'm not sure if I've ever called it out in the video and whether you made the connection or not to go to YouTube if you wanted to watch it. If you want to see the episode with the visual clues that were discussed in the audio version, visit youtube.com/NWNJBA. It's one of the last videos posted up there. Or you could search for episode 83. While you're there, you might note that I posted the footage captured from our June meeting of David Tarpey, the morning session of benefits of genetic diversity within your hives. And besides the episode 83 interview with Tim Schuler, I also have Tim's state apiarist report posted from the June meeting out there too. So a couple videos for you to look at, including if you didn't get to listen to episode 83, you have the option to go back and watch it on video. Roundtable number 6, this is about small hive beetle control. One of our beekeepers called me since the recording of our last episode with concerns of a large population of hive beetles in his hive. Now that's something rather unusual here in New Jersey, but on occasion hive beetles have been known to cause some difficulties. In his case, he wanted to know some strategies for overcoming the infestation he perceived before it became a problem. The typical guidance here is to provide a box where the bees dominate the hive space. If you have too much space and the hive beetles have room to operate, and they're not kept in check by the bees, they can cause problems. The advice is consolidate the hive down to a smaller footprint and let the bees corral the hive beetles. Put some traps in to manage the excess, and after time, for New Jersey, this should rectify the problem. Now, I said for New Jersey, and what I meant by this is if you're in another state, say Florida or other areas of the southern United States, the guidance is different. As the beetles are more assertive and different, and a more aggressive approach is warranted. It wasn't my juncture to go into how to manage small hive beetles there. There's a number of things. I'll get to that in a second here, but I basically wanted to tell you what the outcome of his solution was. I'm happy to report that he said his problem resolved itself without major intervention, and his hive beetle problem is once under control. So we didn't do anything special. So how was it that it came to be that things righted themselves? So you have to look at the backstory to figure it out, and there's some interesting notes about how this could have happened and how it has straightened itself out. The beekeeper, Jim, noted to me that he recently applied some mite away quick strips to his hives and that it knocked the population back some. This likely explains how the beetles came to prevalence for a period of time, and it was the natural recovery, my speculation, of the brood population in his hive along with the deployed mite traps that got the situation back in hand. So much so that he didn't even have to collapse the hive back to a smaller space. So why may he have seen an influx of beetles? In past episodes, I've noted that hive beetles are attracted to rotted fruits, melons, and things like that. When it comes to hives, they are attracted because a similar scent emits from a colony. To my way of thinking, this is the time of year where all the normal foods that they have at their disposal go away, and the bee habitat might be just what they're looking for. So I happen to know one of the farm operations between the two of us, he lives down the road from me, has been cleaning up their stuff, and they're done with their pumpkins and other things. So there's probably nothing out there for them to eat. One last note on this particular situation. Jim mentioned that he had the beginnings of robbing situation at the front entrance of his hive. Remember, the population was down a little bit because the Mitaway quick strips had taken a little abuse on his hive. So he stuffed some different grasses in the entrance as a temporary stopgap to thwart the influx of the robbing situation. And you know what else he may have stopped at the entry? Yep, hive beetles. It's all one interesting ecosystem of ideas. So ironically, that same day, literally, I had another beekeeper who wrote in about a method discovered for preventing hive beetle entry into a hive. And if you're not from New Jersey and you're dealing with this from South Carolina, places with sandy soil, whatever, listen to this part. Jeff Willard posted a video to YouTube outlining various methods that he's tried for thwarting hive beetle entries into his hives. In the video, he outlines what he tried and why it doesn't work, and then he demos an idea that he hit on one that he believes has found success. The solution is an application of flanges with a coating of a new product, or a product that's new to me, called Never Wet. And it creates a surface which the beetles cannot grasp and walk on. The way this works is around the bottom edge of the bottom board that the first hive brood box sets on, the contact area where the wood meets wood, he has an application of the flanges around three of the sides and then one on the trailing edge of the front of that bottom brood box. And if the bees are in the bottom board, they'll naturally just walk up the sides of the bottom board, up the sides of the hive and go in. But with this guide hanging over, this barrier, they can't walk up. And when they walk up and try to walk on this stuff, it's too slippery. Their pads cannot get a grip and they're stuck down on the bottom board. So check out the show notes for a link to the video. And watch his detailed review of how to create a hive beetle barrier that you can put on your own hives and give a try. I say bravo, Jeff, bravo. Roundtable number 7, a couple news and notes from listener mail. First one, our friend Jason Bruns. No relation to Lauren Bruns, of whom I just spoke about in the Zombie Bee segment, wrote in response to the evolution segment we did a bit back on a previous episode with some interesting insights on nature's ability to adapt through evolution. Thanks for the links, Jason. And Jason shared that he caught 20 swarm traps in this year. How friggin' awesome is that? I'm working on a lead that might take us to an important source for tracking feral hives, but more on that in time. And I'll try to pull out a segment on what Jason shared about the different abilities of things to adapt through evolution. This was going back to the article recently that said Tom Seeley work from the 70s was compared to bees in the Arnott forest and the fact that the bees have shown to have evolved over a couple decades. That, I'll drop a little hint, is related to the important source for tracking feral hives, and I'll leave it at that. Gigi Davison wrote in to say that our podcast is a lot like an audible book. I've talked on the podcast how I walk and listen to Audible all the time. She reports that she walks a little bit further while enjoying the podcast, and it usually equates to 2,000 to 3,000 steps every day. Awesome. Beekeeping, learning, and fitness all in one. What's not to like about that? Arnold Nelson shared some research on how varroa mimic bee scents, and that's how they can sometimes infiltrate a hive. I cover so much ground on the podcast that sometimes I can't remember if I've covered things off the cuff, and I have to go back and look it up. But this one sounds familiar to me. I have to see if I could find some time to circle back or bring it up in a future episode. You'll forgive me if I repeat myself sometimes on these topics for sure, because there's so much going on. Thanks, Arnold, for the tip-off on that. Longtime listener Nick Jordan sent a response to our essential oils segment an episode or two ago. He shared a link from Wolf Creek Apiaries on some good essential oil treatment recipes. The web address, wolfcreekbees.com/varroa-mites. And, of course, I'll have a link to that in the show notes. One more to call out. Doug Potter sent in a great guide about native bees that is produced from the USDA. I'll put a link to that in our show notes, and I plan to put a copy on my devices in anticipation of a window of opportunity to sit in and read the 48-page guide sometime at a future opportunity. Thanks, Doug, for that great resource. Roundtable number 8, this one's called Hot Bees Video. This one's posted by Wyatt Magnum, who has the coolest name ever. Wyatt, if you don't know, is a well-known beekeeper, especially for top bar hives. If you go to YouTube and search for Hot Bee as in Boy, S as in Sam, the number 1, Hot BS1, you'll see a Flair, I think that's how you pronounce the name of that brand, FLIR, thermal image of worker bees leaving four forager flights on a cold morning. This is really cool. He has a little commentary in there about the bees. You see the white hot spots surrounded by yellow, surrounded by red. And one of the cool things is he has a number of holes in the front entrance, and you just see these bees heating up. And the discussion is about how they heat their flight muscles before they leave on a cool morning. It's only a minute and 30 seconds. You should go take a look at it. The link to the video from YouTube is always one of those messy things. I'll give it to you, but you're better off just searching for Hot Bees Video the way that I said it earlier. YouTube, youtube.be/WXXRGLV_Y0C. Yeah, now you know why I said search for Hot, H-O-T, Bees, BS1, and you'll find it. Or go to the Wyatt Mangum, WAM channel on YouTube. Check it out. Definitely worth taking a look at. You know, I was thinking the other day that I know that the rescue squad that I used to belong to has a confined space building collapse kit with one of these cameras. And I still know the chief of the squad and a bunch of members over there. Maybe I have to give him a ring and ask him if he wants to do a practice with the device. Come on over to my hives and check them out. What I have out in the yard is a typical Langstroth hive made of wood. And I have my polystyrene hive, and Bob Kloss and I were talking about that recently, where those polystyrene hives don't leak any heat and you can't figure out where the bees are. I'm curious to put that to the test, and I think I'll have to call my friend Tom and ask him if there's any chance he wants to break that device out. One of the things I know about them is they're fairly expensive, but then there's the cheaper versions that you can get with sensors and other things. So yeah, I have to look into that. That's an interesting notion. So I've been plowing through these topics here at the end. I'm a little bit tired, but wanted to finish off the recording of this. I guess we'll get to closing comments. I thought I should share that I still have a few items in the queue concerning a handful of listener mails with accompanying topics, and I'll look to tee them up for the next episode if I can fit them in. I'm trying to keep these episodes to about an hour lately so the download file doesn't get too big. And I wanted to share this commentary with you. I'm not sure. I have some listeners who are reporting that these files are 200 megabyte plus. And I don't know what's going on with that. When I upload it to my web server, it's 80 meg, 90 meg. It's nothing bigger than that. Yet I've had a couple people report that when they're pulling it down from iTunes, it's double the size. I would think that when you click on the link, it's serving it from my server. I'm not sure what's going on with that, but I can assure you I'm not uploading huge mega files. In fact, I've cut the bit rate down on these to make them a little smaller, although I know some of the standards, is a certain encoding rate, and I try to keep them a little bit fatter than most people do, just because I think they sound better. I've heard podcasts come through that are encoded at ridiculously small rates, and they sound tinny, and sometimes people sound like Cylons and whatever. It's bad enough when you're driving in a car with very poor audio to get a poor quality audio coming out the speakers and be able to hear what's going on. I know that frustrates me in my vehicle, so I try to record with a little higher bit rate. So anyway, that's too much information. Let's call that off right now. I recently went to Beekeepers meeting, two of them. One with Landy Simone talking about products of the hive, and another one with Jorik Phillips talking about a device that they created up there at Hudson Valley Bee Supply. It's a dual nuke that sits side by side in a single box. You could buy them from Brushy Mountain. I'll look to see if I could pull out a feature in the next episode for those. Pretty neat conversations up there in both of those meetings. And I'm currently going to the Beginners Rutgers Beekeeping course being taught by Tim Schuler and Bob Hughes. I've never been to one of these beginner courses. I'm filming some sessions for Tim and helping out a little bit if needed, and really enjoying sitting in the audience and hearing it from scratch again. And also, to me, it's refreshing and relevant for the podcast to hear brand new, not even beekeepers yet, ask questions and how they perceive the world. Tim and I and another fellow beekeeper were having a conversation afterwards about how we lose perspective of what it's like to be a newbie and have no sense of how to do this and ask such virgin questions, if I could use that word. And to me, it helps ground me on what people are thinking when they're listening to this for the first time as a new beekeeper. And in fact, one of the things I was thinking is early next spring, one of the things, I think I might come back to a basic beekeeping podcast for you folks. I'll remind everybody that there's a Getting Started in Beekeeping episode back, I don't know the number, look it up in my catalog and you'll find it, where we went through everything in a basic standpoint of how to get started. And yeah, we'll have to put some basic topics. And here's the point for all of the common beekeepers, even if you've been doing it a while. We were having a conversation, Tim, Jeff, and I, about the things that we pulled out, listening to Bob Hughes, that I'd never heard before. It never ceases to amaze me that every session we go to, you hear about a tip, a technique, a perspective on how to do something that will make an impact and change the way you do things forever. So I'm always all ears for these things and really enjoy it. Maybe that's why you come to listen to the podcast. But you don't come to listen to me drone off. So let me see if I can wrap this up and call it a day. Before I go, one last reminder. New Jersey Beekeepers Association has a great meeting coming up on Halloween Day. Go to njbeekeepers.org. Right on the top is the banner for the meeting. Sign up for it. Still, registration is open. And if you could make it, that's going to be a great meeting. If you listen to the podcast and you go to the meeting, be sure to stop and say hello to me. I'd be the guy sitting behind a camera somewhere. As I sit here to wrap things up, I remembered that I wanted to share this funny little thing. I'm looking at my screen. I kept this up so I would remember to talk about it. There's a video that was shot for the Northwest YouTube channel, Swarm Capture with a Vacuum. It was something Bob Kloss shot for us. He vacuums a swarm of bees off of a log. This video has 58,000 views, and there's so many people who have written in comments to it. And one came in today that says, why don't attack IDK, which means I don't know. Why not bother wearing a bee suit? Well, maybe he's immune to bee stings. And in parentheses, it says, including me. It's always interesting what people write in. But somebody wrote in, named Gabriel, in response to that one, I don't know bleep about bees, so forgive me if this is a silly question. How come they don't attack him? Why doesn't he even bother to wear one of those suits we see on TV? So I guess I'll have to take a minute and respond to that. Put these people who are ill at ease, comfort them a little bit. So, yeah, let's go take care of that after we shut the recording down. With that, like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everybody, and be well.